as the dinner was underway, John could sense that the tension in the room, that it was over the top, that things had gotten a little out of hand, as it were. Because the reality was quite simply this, that for some time now, Jesus had talked about leaving, that Jesus would be going away, that Jesus would be leaving, and that he wouldn't be there, and that they couldn't go with him. And so as soon as Jesus began to talk about that, and they didn't know what that meant, but at the time, what people began to do, and these disciples began to do, was kind of begin to line up underneath Jesus. They're creating kind of a pecking order, a hierarchy of sorts. And so while perhaps the conversation in that upper room those thousands of years ago started off kind of with nobility, with this idea of who's going to be the leader, what's succession going to look like, very quickly it had evolved into a rather singular and self-focused question, which is this: which of us is the greatest? And as this conversation is happening and taking place, almost unbeknownst, out of the corner of his eye, John begins to see the master, the teacher, Jesus, stir. And he starts to head over to the wash basin. And in this moment, he's about to do what anybody could have done, but nobody did. And what John begins to see is Jesus take off his outer garment. He reaches for the towel that's there. He wraps it around his waist. And then he begins to take the wash basin. He begins to get in position as if to wash their feet, like a household servant would. And at this point, all the argument, all the tension, all the chaos, the dispute that had arisen, at this point, it just kind of washed away. It got real quiet real quick. A quiet horror kind of filled the place. If you ever been in a place where the level of awkwardness in a conversation or place makes you physically ill, yeah, that's that. And John, I can only imagine John would have scanned the room, made eye contact. The disciples are making eye contact. No one knows what to say. No one's saying or doing anything. And no one knows what to say or do. But they're kind of looking at each other in the eye, kind of like telepathically pleading with each other. Are you going to do something? Are you going to do something? Why aren't you doing anything? Why aren't you doing anything? No words are exchanged. But these pleading with the eyes. And what Jesus begins to do is something anyone could have done, but no one did. And he's in the wash basin, and he's washing their feet. The one who had not several days before raised a man from the dead was kneeling before them, washing their feet, and the Messiah, the chosen one of God. And each time, there's some nasty stuff on their feet, and he's washing it. And with each time his hands go in and out of the wash basin, he's subjecting himself to more and more uncleanness. On this, the Passover feast, the most holy day, most holy Jewish celebration. If ever there's a time not to be unclean at all, it's this time. But that wasn't on Jesus' radar. And then it dawns on John that his Savior, his teacher, his Lord's washing his feet. And it dawns on John that Jesus rode into Jerusalem on a donkey for miles. And guess who was walking behind that donkey all those miles? Every one of those guys in that room. And the thought of what could be on those feet kind of like made John a little bit sick. He's kind of humiliated for his master's sake, right? It turned his stomach a little bit. And so his mind starts to go like, okay, did we somehow force him to do this? Did we force him? And then John kind of put that thought out of his mind because he realized no one forced Jesus to do anything, right? Anytime anyone ever tried to manipulate or coerce Jesus, it just didn't work out that well for them. So he realized, no, that can't be it. Then he thought, maybe this is a test. Is this it? Where's the gotcha moment going to happen? But that didn't sound like Jesus either. So he put that thought out of his mind. And they tried to rationalize. Then, like so many of us, they try to rationalize and in pop the guilt and the shame, right? Because it's kind of like, usually a room like this, it came with a servant to be able to do that. And maybe the giver forgot that part of the gift. Maybe it was an oversight on their part, or worse yet, maybe it was an oversight on our part, they thought. And then, like, when's the hammer going to drop? And would it? And what would Jesus, be? What was that going to be like? And I don't understand what's going on. Lots of confusion. And all the while, Jesus is washing their feet, and Jerusalem was not a clean place. And they walked everywhere. And so in a moment, what Peter does, right? Peter breaks the silence as only Peter can. And you know, a lot of times I can only imagine that Peter broke the silence and You're thinking like, man, what are you thinking? But in this particular case, because he would, you know, Peter would dig a hole. He put both feet in his mouth. He would do all this stuff. He'd just run into it. But the reality is in this moment, when he asked the question that he asked, he gives collective voice to every single disciple that's in that room. And he asked this question. Lord, are you going to wash my feet? And then he emphatically follows it up with, you're never going to wash my feet. You'll never wash my feet. No, never. And every single eye is fixed on Peter and Jesus, and they're just not sure what's going on, but all they know is how's Jesus going to respond to this? Right? Peter's given collective thought to everything we're thinking. How will Jesus respond? And what they don't know is that in this moment, this encounter with Jesus is going to be so profound that they're going to write about it, and we're going to be talking about it thousands of years later. And it's going to alter the course and direction of their lives forever. So let me go ahead and pray, and then we're going to dive into this story, into this text, and we're going to see what it is that the Holy Spirit wants to speak to us today. So let me pray for us. Lord, thank you for this moment. Thank you for this morning, and for everybody that you brought here. I pray that you would open our hearts to receive what it is that you want to communicate to us, and that we would hear it, and we would understand it, and then we wouldn't just keep it in our minds, but we would begin to do it and use our hands to accomplish what you've given us to do. Thank you. I pray that you'd speak to us through your word. I ask this in your name, Jesus. Amen. So my name's Justin. I'm the executive pastor, and I get to kind of launch and kickstart this new series. We're calling it Secret Sauce. And the rationale behind that is we see and we believe in the Bible that there's a lot of great understanding and counsel and insight for building and constructing a recipe for healthy relationships. That's why we've called it Secret Sauce. And essentially in the series, what we're going to be doing is we're going to be looking at these six ingredients. And you kind of see the list there, and each one of those ingredients we're going to spend a week developing. And so I get to talk to you about service, and you kind of see. And as we look at those kind of ingredients, you may be thinking like, okay, I understand these. Why is service at the top? And I want to just say I'm really excited that service is at the top and that I get to kick off this series and share it with you, because I believe that service is the foundation and the expression of every single one of these ingredients, right? To be able to do any of these things, to exercise or express any of these ingredients and build healthy relationships using the godly wisdom, that it's going to require service. It's got to be the foundation. If it's not there, it's not going to happen. Humility is expressed through service. Concern is expressed through service. If you're concerned about someone, never say anything. They don't know. It's the same with encouragement. You can be so encouraging in your mind, but if they don't hear it, it doesn't matter. Prayer, love is wonderful, but it's an action. It's practically expressed. So my heart is that service is the foundation of all of this. Everything is practically expressed, and that's why we're kicking off the series with it. And if I could just kind of posit kind of a big idea as we talk about this topic, as we talk about this idea of service, and use John 13 to kind of share it, it's this, that service prepares us to be in healthy relationships because it takes our focus off of ourselves and turns it outwards. And that's the first step, right? It prepares us to be in healthy relationships because it turns it outwards instead of inwards. So we're going to be looking at John 13, and we're coming out of this series Confident and Unashamed. That's where we've been before Easter. And we talked about the Apostle John many times about who wrote that. Well, he also wrote the gospel, that the part of the gospel we're going to look at today. And the gospel is just, it's a narrative of Jesus' life and his ministry, his teaching, and then his death, burial, and resurrection, what that means. That's what the gospel is. And so John wrote that account of Jesus' life, and we're gonna pop in just a segment of it. And I think as we look at this, really what I want to share is I think there are three principles when it comes to the idea of service. And Jesus is going to share with us three principles and reveal to us how that will build healthy relationships. So let's dive in. So John 13 is where we're going to be. We're going to start right at the beginning of it in verse 1. And so let's take a look up here. Before the Passover festival, Jesus knew that his hour had come to depart from this world to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. So this is like really significant. We know it's Passover. We know it's in the upper room. We know it's a very holy festival. And at the same time, it says his hour had come. So Jesus is about to die. That's what it means by his hour had come. It says he loved his own. That's, he's talking about his disciples. He's talking about his followers. And so when you set the kind of the scene here, what I think is really interesting is this is the day before the crucifixion. This is the day before Good Friday. This is Thursday evening. Set that. Let put that in context. And if I could just be really honest, sometimes when I read the Bible and when I'm reading it, sometimes I wonder why. You know, you see it and you're like, I wonder what that means, or I wonder what that actually means, or I wonder what that means for me. I mean, those are fair questions. Sometimes I ask the question, why is this even in the Bible? I don't know if you ever do that. If I'm the only one, that's okay, I guess. But I always ask that. And this is one of those stories where, I mean, I understand, but I don't quite understand. Like, it doesn't make, when I put my human brain, it just doesn't make sense, right? Jesus is about to commit the most radical act of service in about a day. So why does he need to get down on his hands and knees and wash these men's feet tonight? I mean, it's a powerful illustration, but I mean, when you know like hindsight's 20/20, but when you know what he's going to do, why is this necessary now? I mean, it wouldn't be unreasonable of Jesus to be like, yeah, tomorrow's going to be a really long day, and, you know, like, I'm going to just enjoy you guys, and I'm just going to, that's just not Jesus' style, and that's, I think, what I really love about it. But it also makes me, there's some tension in it for me. And what's neat is that John gives us some insight as what Jesus is thinking as he's, right, as this dinner's going on, as he's about to think about this act of service, here's what's going on in his mind. Jesus knew that the Father had given everything into his hands, that he had come from God, and that he was going back to God, okay? So John's like, Jesus is the most powerful man in the room, and he knows it. Everything's in his hands. He has, another translation says he has authority over all things. So he has everything in his hands. He came from God. He is God. He's going back to God. He'll be with God. This is what's going on in Jesus' mind. So that's when he decides, yeah, you know what? I should wash their dirty, smelly feet. What? It's the most powerful. It's ironic. It's like so ironic. And at the same time, the Gospel of Luke tells us what the disciples in the room were thinking. Here's Jesus being like, I'm going to humble myself. Here's the disciples being like, a dispute also arose among them about who should be considered the greatest. Let the irony of how ridiculous that is wash over you. Jesus is like, yeah, I think I'm going to. And that makes what he does next so impressive. Right? If ever there is, and I think I sometimes love in the Bible where there's those oh crud moments. Like, oh no. And if you're one of the disciples, you're like, I think I'm the greatest. No, you might be. No, I am. I'm definitely the greatest. And then Jesus gets up and washes your feet. You're like, oh no. Oh crud. You know, like that reality. So what's the most powerful man who knows he's the most powerful man? It's not up for debate. In the room gonna do. When he realizes that everything was from God, that he had come from God, that he was going back to God, when he's thinking about all this stuff, what does it happen? 13:4. So he got up. I love that. So he thought this, so I did this. So he got up from supper, laid aside his robe, took a towel and tied it around himself. And then in verse 5, he says this. Next he poured water into a basin and began to wash his disciples' feet and dry them with the towel tied around him. And I just want to, and this is where we're going to get to our first principle. Let me just throw this out there. And I want to encourage you to turn your focus to practical needs. Sometimes when I, you know, we look at some of these stories, we want to find out like, oh, what's the deeper meaning? And that's good. I believe we should spend some time saying, what does it say? What does it mean? And I get that. But there are some times where you look at it, and I don't want to lose sight of this. At the baseline of the story, Jesus is meeting a very practical need. Reality is, it's a Jewish feast. It's a holy feast. Washing has to happen. What has to happen is not up for debate. The who's going to do it and how's it going to work, those are up for debate. And Jesus takes those. I love that. We want to look deep, but let's not always look so deep that we miss what's right in front of us. Turn your focus to practical needs. Meet practical needs for people. This is what Jesus does in the upper room. I don't want to lose sight of that. And then later on, after he does that, we'll come back to what he, as he's doing it, he has a conversation with Peter. We'll come back to that. But in verse 12, he says this. He reclined again and said to them, do you know what I have done for you? At which point I imagine the disciples thinking like, I sure hope this is rhetorical. Because I know, but I don't feel like I know. And then in verse 14, he says this. So if I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. To me, what I think, I just love Jesus in this act is such a genius. He's such a genius. As they're arguing about who's the greatest and the dispute arises, he's like, cool, I'm going to do one act of service, and I'm going to confront you with your sin, convict you of your sin, and then I'm going to give you a model that endures for generations. And then when he goes to discuss it, he's super practical about it. He says this, I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet. You also ought to wash one another's feet. There's so many things he could have finished that statement with. I've washed your feet, so you ought to give me your all. You ought to surrender your hearts to me. You ought to follow me forever. You know, you ought to give up all your possessions. I'm not, you know, they're all things like he could have talked about. He could have said, you need to think about others more. He could have kept it so philosophical. And I'm not saying we shouldn't do any of those things if Jesus is teacher and Lord in our life. I'm not suggesting we don't. I'm just saying, let's not lose sight of the fact that he was super practical. It's like, I washed your feet, so you ought to wash one another's feet. It's practical. I've done this, so you ought to do that. And that word ought is like, it's an economic term. It's a finance term. It really means that there's like an indebted obligation. It's kind of like Jesus, like, I washed your feet, so you owe it to me to wash everyone else's feet. You owe it to me. You owe it to each other. You owe it. Like, that's, like, I just don't want to lose sight of that. Turn your focus to practical needs. And then the reality is, and I just want to share with you, I'm not sure what your thought on that kind of idea, that principle is, but it is a healthy relationship builder for sure. Here's why. I believe it adds value like nothing else can. If you want healthy relationships in your life, you must add value to other people. And the reality is, when we give of our resources, when we give of our money or our possessions, you can make more money, even if it's slowly. You can make more money. You can accumulate more things. But ain't nobody making more time. Time is fixed and finite. When you give your time up, there's just something final about that. You don't get it back. And when you do that for someone else, that adds value like nothing else can. So when you'll turn your focus and meet some of those practical needs, you give your time up. And that adds value to people like you wouldn't believe. It pulls people in a relationship. If there's woundedness, it heals a relationship like nothing else can. It also, on the point of the other person recognizes and realizes, wow, this person saw a practical need, something I'm going through. They notice me. They're concerned for me. And that's attractive, too. It adds value that way. Like, oh, they noticed my situation and they did something about it. That's powerful. Turn your focus to practical needs. Now, I want to also focus on the idea of being practical for a moment, okay? Turn it to practical needs. Go to the next one. This idea of practical, I just want to share this. When we're talking practical needs, they've got to be needs that other people perceive to be needs. That's what it means by being practical. It's got to be a need that someone else feels. If you go meet a need that the other person doesn't think or perceive as a need, that word is called bothering people. But if you want it to actually be legit service, then it really has to be like, I acknowledge this is a need and you met this and it's helpful. If you just do something that you think is a need, but it's not a need for them, it's not going to have the desired effect. They're not going to appreciate it. It's not going to add value. I think nowhere does this maybe come more true in relationships than in marriages. Maybe you've heard of the concept of the five love languages before, okay? If you haven't, it's worth checking out. It's very interesting. But essentially, the idea is that you and I, we loved being loved in certain and specific way, like acts of service or words of affirmation or quality time or some other ones, and I'm forgetting them now, and someone will yell them out like they did last time. But anyway, these five love languages. And so so for my wife, her two are quality time and acts of service. And luckily, mine are completely opposite. Not really. They are. It's not good, though. I really like words of affirmation and gifts. Those are my love languages. Now, and when I'm talking practical needs in marriage, this is where this is a helpful understanding, because me and my wife, we've been married about 10 years. Okay, we just hit our 10-year wedding anniversary. It's been really cool. But I remember year one. Year one, you know nothing. I felt like I knew nothing. If you feel like you know everything, good on you. But year one, I remember I just didn't understand this concept. So the needs I met for my wife were not practical. They weren't perceived as needs. So in marriage, that healthy relationship, I remember I would work too much. I'd come home late. Her desire, quality time, right? We'd be home on time. And I'm like, I bet I will try. They never want to hear that, okay? I will try to be home on time. And she's like, it's just yes or no. I'm like, you're right. So yes, I will try. You know? Anyway, it's been a struggle of mine, but I'd come home late, which she wouldn't appreciate, and then I would operate out of my love language and meet a need that she didn't really have. I remember there were some times I brought her candy bars. It is stupid, okay? You guys are like, I'm not sure how to take that. My wife doesn't care about candy bars, okay? She'd much prefer, I'm like, hey, I'm sorry I'm late, but I did bring you this candy bar, you know? Like, That may work in elementary school, but not when you're an adult. So I've wised up, and I've started to turn my focus to practical needs, like in my marriage. Like most recently, there was a time her knives were getting dull. Like for, you know, just as she was cooking in the kitchen, she likes having sharp knives. That makes sense. And so I was thinking, man, maybe we'll invest in some Cutco knives. And I thought if we invest now, like after 50 years, maybe we'll have enough, you know, like because they're really expensive. So I was like, but it would still be a great gesture. Maybe we'll just start investing. It'll be super cool. And then I thought, acts of service. She'd probably appreciate it if I just sharpened her knives. So that's what I did, like for, not the only thing I did, okay? But like for Christmas, I just sharpened her knives. I just sat there on the couch and sharpened her knives. And afterwards, she's like, oh my goodness, this is perfect. And I'm like, well, you're welcome, you know? But it's like turning your focus to practical needs. It's powerful, it adds value. It works in marriage, it works at work, it works in friendships, it just does. Why? Because it's Jesus's insight, and his insight just makes sense. Whether you're a follower of Jesus or not, these principles, it just makes sense. Let's keep going with the story. We're going to hit our second principle here. He came to Simon Peter, who asked him, Lord, are you going to wash my feet? And then Jesus says this, right? When Peter asked him this, Jesus answered him, what I'm doing you don't understand now, but afterward you will know. And if I get that response from Jesus, my thought is like, okay, then I'll just be quiet. Peter says something else. He says this, right? You will never wash my feet, ever, Peter said. Jesus replied, if I don't wash you, you have no part with me. Yeah, you know, there's a little bit like, I get, if you want to wash my feet, man, go for it. You know what I mean? Like, doesn't it seem kind of, it almost seems extreme, like, what? It's just about feet, you know what I mean? Like, I didn't want you touching my feet, you know? But the reality is, like, there's an underlying thing going on. There's a deeper tension at play here. Peter's thinking shallowly about literally washing feet, and Jesus is talking about something far deeper, because you're going to see what his response to that is. And Jesus replied, if I don't wash you, you have no part with me. And Simon Peter, and I love Peter's response, because he's like, well, if that's on the table, then Lord, not only my feet, but my hands and my head, let's just do this all right, you know? And then how you hear Jesus say the next words and the next phrase really matters. Because does Jesus say this next phrase? He says this. Let me just read what he says. One who has bathed, Jesus told him, doesn't need to wash anything except his feet, but he is completely clean. Does Jesus say that to Peter with like, oh, I can't believe you say that, you're so ignorant? Or does Jesus say it with a smile on his face? And I believe that you have to see it with joy in Jesus' eyes as he says this. I believe that matters. I believe as Jesus is looking at Peter, there is joy in his face at Peter's response, like, yes. I mean, maybe a little laughter, like, okay, I don't think you still get it, but I like you, Peter. I love that. And here's what's really going on. There is a deeper pride issue. Because Peter's thinking like, I just don't want you to wash my feet. You're high, I'm low. I don't want you to wash my feet. And Jesus is saying like, hey, let's talk about spiritual pride for a second. And let me get real with you. Because Jesus knows what's coming. And just a little bit, just from last week, Jesus is going to talk to Peter about how they're gonna arrest Jesus, and Peter's going to deny Jesus three times. And it's almost like Jesus is kind of saying, Peter, if I can't meet this really specific and practical need with you, this practical gesture of service, if you won't allow this, why would you ever come back to me when you deny me three times? If you will not receive this practical service from me now, why would you ever receive grace from me then? Why would you ever come back to me? So let's break through that blockade first, Peter. As Peter begins, I don't think he realizes all of that. He clearly doesn't. Maybe in hindsight, as an old man, he would. But I think that's where Jesus is going. Jesus is breaking through pride, and I believe that's critical. And here's that second principle. And it's the first one flipped on his head. If we're going to turn our focus to meet practical needs, the reality is someone is going to do that for us. And that's where we need to drop our resistance to receiving help. Drop your resistance to receive help. Because if you're unwilling to receive help, I'm going to be honest with you and kind, but I've struggled with this myself. It might be a pride issue. It might be something that needs to be rooted out. And pride is a relationship breaker. It just does. It is. And I believe if we'll drop resistance to receiving help, it will lead to healthy relationships. It requires humility to serve, and it requires humility to receive. Dr. Brené Brown, she says this. It's a really interesting quote. Until we can receive with an open heart, we're never really giving with an open heart. When we attach judgment to receiving help, we knowingly or unknowingly attach judgment to giving help. If you give to people, let me just put it the opposite. When you receive help from someone, if you feel guilty and ashamed, odds are good that when you give help to someone else, you meet a need, you do so with this, maybe subconsciously, with this attitude of maybe judgment or shame, or they should feel guilt at what I'm doing for them. I believe it just comes in so subtly that if you're feeling that when you receive help, then when you give it, it just gets reflected too. And the thing is, when that happens, it's a relationship breaker. People, oddly enough, people do not like feeling judged. They just don't. And they have a sixth sense about it too. And when they assign any kind of judgment to what you're doing or what you're thinking, they just don't want anything to do with it. And if you're going to stand, and if anyone's going to stand in a seat of judgment, usually that's a person that's standing by themselves. I think at work this is really tough. I work at a church and I can attest, I get this. It's hard to drop resistance to receiving help, especially at work. Here's why, because the thought is I'm at work, and if I reach out for help, then the lie that I buy, that Satan will try and get me to take, the lie that he will put in my face is, that's because you're weak. I can just say, men, no one wants to be weak. I don't want to be weak at work. If my boss perceives me, if I have to ask for help, it means I can't handle my project load, my workload. I can't manage my team. If I can't take care of the responsibilities that my boss has given me now, why would he ever give me more in the future? This isn't going to work. I can't be weak. If receiving help means weakness, then I can't receive help. Can't be weak. But when you will receive help, you'll find people give you grace. Humility brings grace. It just does. The opposite is a people repeller. I'll tell you a story. I was at work when I was a teacher, first year teacher, which is synonymous with I didn't know anything. Okay? Amen. Yes, I'm a first-year teacher. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm trying, though, and I'm lecturing, and so this isn't me. Okay, that's not me. If that was me, something terrible happened over the years. Okay? But I was leaning back like this guy was on what they called a cow, and it's a computer on wheels is what it stands for. It's a big case. It has a bunch of laptops. You plug it in, and it's a really helpful tool in the classroom, but it has these awesome handrails that catch your pants. Okay? Anyway. So I'm sitting against it, and I'm kind of lecturing, and sometimes I like spring forward or something. Like I did it, I always do it. Okay, so I just did it, but my pants didn't all the way come with me. So here I am, first year teacher, and the moment that happened, nobody knew, but I knew. I mean, I could feel it, and I just knew it was like, oh no. So my shirt was tucked in, so I untucked it and let the tail conceal the hole, but I was like, and I just knew it was getting bigger. Like, I just knew it was like, this isn't going to make it. This the rip's going to be all the way down to my knee. I can't do this. Now, here's the cool thing, I just happened to have an extra pair of pants in my car that day, and I would have an extra pair of pants for the next 2 years. But in that moment, I didn't know how. I was like, how do I get out of my classroom? How do I do this? How am I supposed to go? So I had to do it. I had to humble myself, and I had to go to this teacher. And I didn't have a great relationship with the teacher in the pod. We just kind of did our own thing. After this, we had a much better relationship, right? Because it's just when you humble yourself, people give you grace. And I walked in. I was like, ma'am, I need your help. Will you cover my class for a little bit? I ripped my pants. And she's like, uh-huh. Like, it was just like that. And I did. And so I'm just saying now I hope you don't rip your pants at work, okay? I hope that is not, but I'm just saying that if you'll receive help, if you'll drop your resistance to receiving help, it will usher in healthier and better relationships, because people oppose proud people, but they give grace to humble people. That's just what they do. That's healthy. So I just want to encourage you in that. That's the second principle. The third one, this is the last one, leverage your power for the benefit of others. Leverage your power for the benefit of others. Let's go back to verse 3 for a moment. John 13:3. Jesus knew. He's the most powerful man in the room. The Father had given everything. He'd come from God. He was going back to God. This is what Jesus knew. And he was the one that washed their feet. And in that moment, really what he's essentially doing is he's leveraging his power for the benefit of the others in the room. This is a principle we can't, this is the most important principle that sums up the entirety of the story, really. Leverage your power for the benefit of others. Jesus is the most powerful man in the room. So what does the most powerful man do? Gives that power away. He leverages it for the benefit of those who are in the room. But I also love Jesus' confidence and self-assurance too. Because leveraging your power for the benefit of the others is service. It doesn't mean that you're humiliated all the time. It doesn't mean you have to be super insecure or weak or anything like that, because Jesus is absolutely not weak when he does this. Later on when he's talking, he says this in 13. He says, you call me teacher and Lord, after it's all over, you call me teacher and Lord. And then I love this, and this is well said, because that's exactly what I am. You call me teacher and Lord, and that's good, because I am. Like, yeah, you know what I mean? Like, so leveraging your power for the benefit of the others isn't being a doormat. It's just saying, I'm the most powerful person, but I'm not going to act like it. I'm going to leverage my power for your benefit. And this is powerful. Jesus does that, and he knows who he is. And 14 says, so if I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. And then I like what he says in 16. I think it's neat. It says, I assure you, a slave is not greater than his master, and a messenger is not greater than the one who sent him. But in the context, Jesus is like, yeah, but I'm the master, and you're the servant. I'm the one who sent you, you're the messenger. If I'm willing to wash crud off people's feet, guys, how low will you go? What will you give up? How low will you, if that's me, if a master, if a servant is not greater than his master, a messenger not greater than the one who sent him, and I'm the one who sent you, and I'm the master, and I'm doing this, what does it say about what you should be doing, what we should be doing? Like, that to me, it's like, I think that's just so significant. So Jesus leverages power for the benefit of the others and isn't a doormat at all. How does this lead to healthy relationships? Well, quite honestly, there is nothing more attractive than this. In life, when you line up underneath authority and do what the person that's in power above you asks you to do, that's called keeping your job. And if you do something different than that, it's called being let go. Like, you know what I mean? Like, that's not, like, this person's in control, I do what they say. Like, that's not uncommon. I mean, good on you, but that's not uncommon. What is uncommon is, I'm the one with the power, and I'm leveraging it for your benefit. I'll lay it aside, lay it down for you and for your benefit, for your good. And there's nothing that's more attractive than that. There's a Malaysian proverb that talks, it says, the fuller the ear of rice grain, the lower it bends. The fuller the ear of rice grain, the lower it bends. When you have a lot of power, you gotta go a lot low. That's just a reality. That's the way Jesus designed it to work, and that's what Jesus modeled. And that's what brings health in those relationships. Leverage your power for the benefit of the others. James 4:6, James, the brother of Jesus, says this: God opposes the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. People made in the image of God do the same thing. We don't like prideful, arrogant people. We'll oppose them. We'll work against them. But the one who is humble, oh, that's the ones like we overlook. We give them second chances. We overlook imperfections. We assume the best. We give the benefit of the doubt. We do that, and when we will do that, leverage our power for the benefit of others, other people will do that too. If there are broken relationships, this will be the balm that heals them. It really does. If there are no relationships, this will be how you start them right. This is cool. This is a third principle. Leverage your power for the benefit of others. When you do that, people sense that you're on their side too, and they like that. And you get to really be on their side. We were in the teaching team meeting this week, kind of working on some of this stuff, and someone mentioned a podcast that talked about this speaker named John O'Leary. He wrote a book a couple of years ago called On Fire. His story is powerful, tragic, and inspiring all at the same time. As a 9-year-old boy in the late 80s, John, he suffered third-degree burns over 100% of his body in a tragic accident. Given 1% survival rate, he's alive. He's got 4 beautiful kids. It's a really cool, God's using him in mighty ways. That's, I mean, just that. But he talks about being 1% survival rate. Because at the time, he's like all bandaged up. He can't breathe on his own. He can't see, you know, but he can hear everything. And he distinctly remembers, and he talks about it in this podcast. He talks about the doctor would come into his room each day, really honestly ask him how he was doing, you know, check in on him, you know. And then one of the things this doctor would also do was he would bring in, like, the nurses and the orderlies and the custodians. He would bring this custodian in named Lavelle, specifically. Sit Lavelle down on the bed and say, that boy's still alive, and it's because of you, sir. Because what this doctor knew, in a burn unit, the number one killer is infection. And he knew that if that janitor, that custodian, minimum wage guy, would do his job well, that boy would live. And so he would look that guy in the eye and say, Lavelle, this boy's alive. Thank you, sir. Thank you. You know, it's like, the doctor is the most powerful man in the room. And what did he do? He gave it away. He leveraged his power for someone else's benefit. Like, that's powerful. Like, if you do that in relationships, friendships, if you do that in your marriage, if you'll do that at work, man, it'll change your work environment, honestly. It just works. Whether you're a follower of Jesus or not, I believe this is just the way healthy relationships work and function best. That's the third principle. Leverage your power for the benefit of others. Let me also say this. I got to be honest, and this is where it comes back. I don't think all of these things are, these principles to really live out truly are possible always apart from Jesus. Or is powerful. They're not powerful apart from the gospel, apart from Jesus in my place. Here's why. Because if you're going to turn your focus to practical needs, if you're going to drop your resistance to receiving help, if you're going to leverage your power for the benefit of others, all of those principles come from a heart that cries and says, my life for yours. The problem or the challenge is, apart from Jesus, apart from this reality that Jesus is in my place, that the good news is real, that he died for me and was raised to life, and I get that, and he took my sins on his, apart from that understanding, all of us are trying to fill a hole in our life. And we will look to relationships to do it. Apart from that idea, that understanding the gospel of Jesus being in my place, every relationship is going to work to try and fill that hole. And that means everybody at some point kind of owes me something. You owe me something. That makes every relationship kind of like debt collector and debtor. Debt collector and debtor. There can't be openness, there can't be healing, there can't be health. But, and see, this is where the gospel changes everything. But if the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and this is critical, and give his life as a ransom for many, taking the weight of the sins on his back, if he did that, if that's true, if Jesus is in my place, then the reality is I can confidently cry my life for yours because he cried it first. And if one man stood in my place, his riches are my riches. His fullness is my fullness. When every relationship in my life lets me down, he is the one that sustains me. And that means I get to operate. I really operate. I can operate at a deficit. I don't have to get my needs met by that, by the other person. I can operate at a deficit. I can cancel all those debts. No one, when we really get to a place where no one owes us anything because Jesus has paid for everything, then that's when our hearts get to cry, my life for yours. And all of these principles can be acted upon. I just believe that's just the way it works, and I think it's really neat. And I will say that if we will serve the city in that way, then they'll see Jesus. If we'll serve, they'll see Jesus. I think every single act of service, Jesus has made a way for people to have life, an abundant life. And every act of service that you and I do, it starts pointing them towards Jesus. I believe that is good news. And so I want to encourage you with that. So ultimately, what I really want to share, if I could give you just one next step, and this is where I'm going to encourage you, take a look at that card that you have. But this is the one next step I want to share. It's find your next way to serve. And you have a card that was on your chair, and if you don't, it could be that you're sitting on it right now. And so you should relocate that to your hands. You're going to find your next way to serve, and I want to give you this tool for doing. We're going to make full use of these three screens. Here we go. This is the card you have. That's the front. This is the back. You're going to see these different ministry areas. Some of them are internal. Some of them are inside our walls, and some are outside the walls. The reality is the people that aren't here, we've got to go to them. We've got to get out of our walls and go towards them. At the same time, when people show up here, we never know if it's going to be their first or their last time. So the way we care for people inside and outside our walls really matters. And that's why all of these are really significant and important. So these are some specific ministry areas. When you check this, if you can take this card, you can drop it in the box, you can go to Connection Point. When you check this card, it doesn't say I'm signing up for life, like please sign me up for life. No, it just says I'm interested in this area and I'd like to hear from somebody, find out what opportunities are there. I've got some questions and I'd love to ask. I'm interested and I want someone to talk to me about this. That's all you're committing to, which is just having a conversation, okay? So I just want you to know that. The other thing is you're kind of, if you want to know like, okay, what are specific roles or functions or needs under each one of those areas? That's a great question that I ask myself. Anyway, you're going to visit thundermountain.org, and you can actually do all of this card online as well. When you go to thundermountain.org, you're going to see at the top bar there, it says serve. You're going to click on ministry opportunities, and this is the page you're going to pop up on. That first tab, it says find out where to serve. That's gonna. If you're curious about that, you want to find out where you fit best, this will help you with that. It's a great way. It's a great tool for helping you with that. Now, if you're looking at this list and you're thinking, I don't think any of these are a good fit for me, but I'm passionate and I'm gifted here, yeah, let us know. I can't tell you how many ministry opportunities or ministry positions or ministries haven't existed but now exist because someone did that. That's on the table for sure. So this online will help give a little bit of clarity to what you see on this card. And if you're thinking like paper and pens, this is the 21st century, I understand that too. So you can actually fill this whole card online at that spot too. I just want to let you know. And that would be just my encouragement. Find your next way to serve. Find your next way to serve. And there's opportunities there, both inside and outside the walls. The gospel is my life for yours. And because Jesus did that for us, we are empowered to do that for others. So that's just my heart. Let me pray for us. And I just encourage you with those cards. You can put those in the box or drop them off at Connection Point or do it online.